The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. My name is Eli Taylor. As a husband, a father of six children, and a full-time member of our pastoral staff at my church, I'm often reminded how important a Christian worldview is. I'm thankful for the world and everything in it for refocusing me on that very point every morning. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Thanks in part to COVID, homeschooling is on the rise, especially among Black families.
He knows a little bit about every country in Africa, and he doesn't really know about Europe yet. And I love that that's an option, because that's not necessarily the way a school system is normally set up.
Also, analysis of the Rittenhouse trial, now in the hands of the jury. Plus, a story about a small town with a big problem.
People just hate to believe that a man of God would do such a thing.
And commentator Cal Thomas on the government's waste of your tax money.
It's Thursday, November 18th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Myrna Brown. Good morning.
Now here's Kent Covington with today's news.
The Biden administration is backing away from its planned vaccine mandate for private businesses, at least for now. OSHA is the government agency that would enforce the mandate. In a statement Wednesday, it said it is abiding by a court order that OSHA take no steps to implement or enforce the vaccine requirements until further court order. That after the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a stay on the mandate. OSHA had given companies with more than 100 employees until January 4th to require their indoor workers to be vaccinated against COVID-19 or get tested weekly. It said violators could face fines of up to $14,000 per offense. Hackers linked to the Iranian government have been targeting a broad range of victims inside the United States with ransomware and other attacks. World's Kristen Flavin reports.
American, British, and Australian officials issued an advisory on Wednesday. It said that in recent months, Iran has exploited computer vulnerabilities exposed by hackers before they can be fixed. The attacks targeted entities in the transportation, healthcare, and public health sectors. According to the advisory, the attackers then leveraged the initial hack for additional operations, such as data exfiltration, ransomware, and extortion. Officials say the hackers have used the same Microsoft Exchange vulnerability in Australia. Microsoft announced Tuesday that it had seen six different groups in Iran deploying ransomware since last year. The warning is notable because even though ransomware attacks remain prevalent, most of the significant ones in the past year were linked to Russia-based groups rather than Iranian hackers. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
Meantime, Iran continues to ramp up its nuclear program. The United Nations Atomic Watchdog says it believes that Iran has further increased its stockpile of highly enriched uranium. The International Atomic Energy Agency warned member states in its confidential quarterly report on Wednesday. It said Iran has an estimated stock of 39 pounds of highly enriched uranium, which can be easily refined to make atomic weapons. But the agency is unable to verify Iran's exact stockpile of enriched uranium, as Iran is no longer cooperating with inspectors. For the first time ever, estimated drug overdose deaths topped 100,000 in the United States in a 12-month period. Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra said Wednesday,
I think it's time we just recognize that we've been struggling in trying to deal with this epidemic. And since COVID-19 hit, it's gotten worse.
The CDC estimated on Wednesday that 100,300 people died of a drug overdose between May of 2020 and April of this year. That is an increase of nearly 30% from the same period 1 year earlier. Opioids accounted for 75% of overdose deaths. The drug supply has become much more dangerous because suppliers are lacing methamphetamines and cocaine with fentanyl, that is a powerful synthetic opioid. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin called out Russia on Wednesday for endangering the International Space Station. A Russian weapons test sent more than 1,500 pieces of debris flying through space. Russia insists the debris is not a threat to the space station, but Secretary Austin disagreed.
It's a safety concern, and so we would call upon Russia to act more responsibly going forward.
U.S. officials on Monday said Russia destroyed an old satellite with a missile and what they called a reckless and irresponsible strike. According to NASA Administrator Bill Nelson, astronauts now face four times greater risk than normal from space junk. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, homeschooling's growing appeal among Black families, plus the hidden cost of the new infrastructure spending bill. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Thursday, the 18th of November, 2021. You're listening to today's edition of The World and Everything in It, and we're so glad to have you along with us. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Myrna Brown. First up, home education.
Some people say we're goofy, mysterious and spooky. Our neighbors think we're kooky, a homeschool family. We drive a white conversion. We learn about the Persians. Our six-year-old's a surgeon, a homeschool family.
As COVID-19 sent many students home in 2020, more and more families turned to homeschooling. But the jump was even more noticeable among African-American families. According to the Census Bureau, the percentage of Black families educating children at home grew fivefold in just 6 months. In April 2020, just over 3% of Black families homeschooled their children. A year and a half later, 16%.
Homeschooling statistics for this school year aren't yet available, but some experts and homeschoolers think the trend could well continue. World correspondent Lauren Dunn reports.
Jasper and Dia Abbott's son attended a public pre-K during the 2019 to 2020 school year. When schools went virtual in March 2020, Abbott said it was kind of chaotic. She and her husband prayed about what to do for their son's kindergarten year.
My mom is a public high school teacher. Her mom had been a public kindergarten teacher. My sister is a public school teacher. My brother-in-law is a public school teacher. Public school was in my blood. And I had a really great experience in public school. So it was not at all anything I ever would have considered before the pandemic.
But the Abbott's concerns about COVID-19 and virtual instruction convinced them to give homeschooling a try. They pulled their son out of public school in fall 2020, the weekend before he would have started kindergarten.
I'm white. My husband is Black, and so our son is mixed, but he also identifies as Black.
Abbott had already planned to supplement her son's education around his heritage if he went to public school. But with homeschooling, she found even more opportunities.
I love imbuing heritage into what we're doing. He knows a little bit about every country in Africa, and he doesn't really know about Europe yet. And I love that that's an option, because that's not necessarily the way a school system is normally set up.
Stephen Duvall is the director of research at the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. He said that in previous years, African-American families homeschooled at about half the rate of white families. But more recent surveys show the Black homeschooling rate is only a couple of percentage points behind that of white families. That shift began even before 2020. According to a 2015 report by Brian Ray at the National Home Education Research Institute, the number of Black homeschooling families nearly doubled from 1999 to 2012. Khadisha Ali Coleman was one of those families. She homeschooled her daughter off and on until her daughter graduated this past May. Ali Coleman is also the co-founder of Black Family Homeschool Educators and Scholars. It's a research group that provides virtual training for parents.
But I will tell you anecdotally that for many families, particularly those who were homeschooling before COVID-19, number one reason why many families were pulling their children out of schools was because the lack of teaching about not only Black history, but teaching history in a way that centers the experiences or even includes the experiences of people who are non-white in a way where they are contributors to the society and where their existence doesn't begin with slavery and enslavement.
Emily Powell is a representative for National Black Home Educators. She told me new families are homeschooling for various reasons. Some chose to homeschool due to COVID-19 restrictions or virtual learning situations. Others are concerned about schools teaching critical race theory. Homeschool mom Amber O'Neill Johnston said she has seen more Black families involved since she started homeschooling about 7 years ago. But the growth has really exploded in the past 2 years. In 2016, Johnston started Heritage Homeschoolers, a group for African-American homeschoolers in the Atlanta area. Before starting Heritage Homeschoolers, Johnston and her husband participated in another homeschool group. They enjoyed it, despite being the only Black family. But their daughter began to say negative things about her own skin and hair and stopped playing with her Black dolls.
I was very confused because it's not like anyone had been mean to her or that they weren't including her in things. And I just didn't understand where it was coming from.
The Johnstons never left their first homeschooling group, but they decided to look for other Black homeschooling families. Soon, Heritage Homeschoolers was born, and it kept growing. It now serves 280 children from 94 families.
So it wasn't just my daughter who had this need. Since then, I found that many of the Black families in our community or families with Black children in our community also were experiencing similar problems and had a similar need.
When Dia Abbott began researching her homeschooling options, she found out about Heritage Homeschoolers.
I had found Amber's site, and then I was like, oh, wow, she is here. And there is a homeschool group for melanated kids. And so we hopped into that right as we were hopping into homeschooling, and it's been a really, really beautiful fit for us.
Abbott said that it is possible her son might return to public school at some point, but right now she can't imagine not homeschooling. On a recent trip to Oklahoma, the family combined their travel with learning opportunities.
We saw prairie dogs, and we went to the top of Mount Scott, and we were looking at bison, and we were doing all this stuff. And my dad was with us, and at the end of the day, he was like, it felt really leisurely. We didn't feel rushed, but I don't know how we did everything we did. We did so much. We saw so much. And I told him that is how homeschooling feels to me just about every day.
Amber O'Neill Johnston believes the uptick in homeschooling will continue, especially now that there are more support groups and options for single or working parents.
Parents have had an opportunity to see their children just flourish at home. So when everyone was forced to bring the kids home, Black families in large numbers saw how beautiful it was and what it could look like, what life could be like, and also how happy the children were to just be home with their parents.
Reporting for World, I'm Lauren Dunn.
Well, coming up next on The World and Everything in It, the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. Jurors in Kenosha, Wisconsin, deliberated for a second straight day on Wednesday, preparing to decide the fate of Kyle Rittenhouse. The now 18-year-old young man showed up in the streets of Kenosha last August carrying a semi-automatic rifle amid ongoing protests and riots over a police shooting of a Black man. Rittenhouse said he drove to Kenosha from his home 30 minutes away in Illinois to protect area businesses from looters.
During an altercation with several men, he fatally shot two and wounded a third. He claims it was self-defense. Rittenhouse faces five felony charges. The most serious is a first-degree intentional homicide. If convicted of that charge, he faces a mandatory sentence of life in prison.
Joining us now to talk about it is Steve Meacham. He is an associate professor of criminal justice at Cedarville University in Ohio. He served for more than 30 years with the New York State Police as a trooper and then later as a senior investigator with the state's Bureau of Investigation. Professor, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, with your background as an investigator, let me start with a question about process. If you were an investigator in Wisconsin and were called upon to lead the investigation into this incident, what sorts of things would you be looking for?
Well, in this particular case, you have various crime scenes. And so it'd be really crucial and important to ensure that you actually secure each crime scene and begin to process what criminal evidence, what evidence would actually be helpful to determine what actually took place. And so that would be crucial. You need a lot of people to do that. Given the chaos that was taking place in Kenosha at that time, to be able to secure each of those scenes. So that would be the first step in the investigation. And then you'd begin to actually interview people, talk to witnesses, find out who saw what. Obviously, you'd want to try to find who it was that had actually shot the weapon to actually find out who the perpetrator was in this particular act and track them down for sure. So lots of things to do from a physical evidence standpoint, but also from interviews and getting the proper information. It's all about collecting information, finding out the truth as far as what took place.
Okay, now the trying of this case is, of course, dependent upon state law there in Wisconsin. And I'll ask about the defense in just a moment. But what did the prosecution have to prove here in order to get a felony conviction against Rittenhouse?
Well, the prosecution had to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that Kyle Rittenhouse had actually committed murder. Intentional murder is what the top charge is here. Clearly, we have two people that died in this case. But you have to understand that there's a difference between murder, the unlawfully killing of someone, and what is homicide. Homicide is by definition when somebody takes the life of another person. We clearly have two cases of homicide, but homicide can be justified. And if it's justified, then it's not unlawful. And so I think that's the key here. The prosecution actually had to prove that the killings took place in an unlawful, unjustified manner, that it was intentional murder.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the judge in this case explained state law with regard to self-defense. He said a person may use deadly force only if he reasonably believed the force used was necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to his own person. Is that the sum total of what Rittenhouse's lawyer had to prove, that he feared for his life, or was there more to it?
Well, that is a necessary element to show that this was a case of self-defense. The defense attorney for Kyle Rittenhouse had to explain that Rittenhouse was actually under attack in each of these cases, that his life was in danger, or that he was possibly being subjected to a very serious physical injury, and he felt the need to justify his actions by using deadly physical force in a way to stop that threat.
Yeah, you know, I noticed the prosecution's trial strategy changed as the trial progressed, didn't it? Why and how?
Well, I think that the prosecution was facing an uphill battle and began to introduce certain things that seemed to be not really relevant to the case. And, you know, one of the issues was the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse was armed with this AR-15. But in fact, Kyle Rittenhouse had a legal right to actually possess a weapon. And in fact, the judge threw out the count as far as the unlawful possession of a weapon charge. And so tried to introduce that as well as other things, perhaps to show that Rittenhouse was there for purposes. In the words of the prosecutor, I think he indicated that he was there to kill. He had said to the jury in the courtroom that there was only two people that were killed that night, and they're both killed by Kyle Rittenhouse, without really providing the context and the understanding of the fact that Rittenhouse was actually pursued, chased down, and before he shot Mr. Rosenbaum. And then and the same thing with the shooting that took place a short time thereafter. He again was attacked and knocked to the ground and hit with a skateboard and stomped on, and then another person pointed a pistol at him. Those are indications that there is probably a good argument for self-defense in those particular circumstances.
Well, the judge criticized media coverage of the trial on Wednesday, and he said that he would reconsider allowing televised trials in the future. What role might the media coverage and the judge's comments play in the future of this case?
Well, yeah, it's difficult to say. One of the things you want to do is try to protect the jury from any outside interference. And so if there's anything that's going to transpire with the media and cameras and such that may be impacting the jury, the judge will probably disallow that. And so in order for our system, the criminal justice system to work effectively here in our country, we got to make sure that we have an impartial jury that is not swayed by other things outside of what the facts are of every individual case, without being swayed by public opinion or media or anything like that.
Professor Steve Meacham with Cedarville University has been our guest today. Professor, we thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, connecting Christians who care for one another spiritually and financially when a medical need arises. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast. From ChristianBook.com, great gifts to help you bring on the joy. ChristianBook.com. And from Dort University, offering reimbursed campus visits to show you firsthand how Dort's Christ-centered education leads to lifelong discipleship. Details at dort.edu/visit.
Today is Thursday, November 18th. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, a story of abuse and recovery. And here we will pause for just a moment in case you have young ones around. This story is one you may want to hit pause and come back to later. It deals with disturbing events. Well, 20 years have passed since allegations against a popular minister rocked a rural southern community to its core. But the headlines from that case seem hauntingly familiar today. Abuse covered up and denied for decades. Victims left wounded in its wake.
World senior correspondent Kim Henderson comes now to introduce Truth Be Told, a special podcast series in four parts, available for download beginning this Saturday.
We lived probably 7 or 8 minutes from the church in their house. There was a phone call to our house stating that they seen individuals and heard threats of them coming toward our place to potentially kill us all.
It's the last week of February 2001. Dark has fallen, and even though daffodils have decided it's time to bloom, winter's cold still lingers. Maybe that's why Nathaniel Lamb is shivering, or maybe it's something else. He's barely 14, an eighth grader with sandy hair, wire-rimmed glasses, and size 13 sneakers. Unlike other kids his age, Nathaniel has never seen Jurassic Park or any of the Star Wars thrillers. But right now, a real drama is unfolding, and he's at the center of it. Nathaniel Lamb is living moments he'll have on instant recall for the rest of his life.
Dad, Mom got us all into a room, and it was the furthest room that had the most walls that would protect us, and we feared that bullets would come through the wall and that we would not make it out alive that night.
The Lambs live in JS, Mississippi, a sparse community built around railroad tracks laid to transport timber 100 years ago. Their frame house sits close to the road on 16th section land. An open pasture stands between the back door and woods Nathaniel likes to explore. The closest house is a half a mile away.
I remember my dad gathering us around in a circle in that living room that night, crying out for help to our God. We turned off all the lights, locked all the doors. We didn't want no evidence that we were in the house or any indication what room we were in.
Just 48 hours earlier, Nathaniel sat in the same living room. It was then his mom had pressed him to tell the truth. She wouldn't let up. Nathaniel's dad, a hardworking 12-hours-a-day diesel mechanic, was there too. But nothing could have prepared the Lambs for what their only son told them. Now, with their whole world turned upside down, the family of six is huddled on the floor close to the piano.
I kind of creep to the side, away from the circle, by myself. I remember kneeling down, wondering what's going to happen next. And I just simply closed my eyes with my knees bent to the ground and my face on the carpet of the floor and said, God, will you help me? And it was in that moment, it was just a small nudge of hope and peace that God was going to help me through this and God was going to keep us and keep us safe.
This story is about a shocking criminal case.
We walked down into the woods about 100 yards from their house, and Nathan said, David Earl King had gave me this to use.
One that involves religion.
You know, you don't mess with the preacher. People just hate to believe that a man of God would do such a thing.
Power.
I will refer to him as King. I won't ever say his whole name.
Money.
I started reading it and reviewing the court records, and I couldn't put it down.
Violence.
I'm not only keeping a secret from my family, but I'm dealing with the guilt of what happened.
And abuse.
This is not stranger danger. That was common when I was a kid. That mantra is baloney. Most perpetrators are people the victim knows because that's how they have access to them.
More than three decades of abuse. That's what the Associated Press reported on March 10th, 2001, the day a circuit court judge denied bail for the accused abuser, David Earl King. It began a process that could put him away for the rest of his life.
And they were so worried that I was going to back out, you know, that I was going to kind of get under stress and just drop it. And I looked at Bill Goo and I said, I ain't doing it. We're going to go through this.
A few years ago, I met Susie Harville while working on a different crime story, one about human trafficking.
A lot of people, it's ugly, and they don't want to get involved. We're churchy people, and we absolutely don't talk about things like this.
In January 2021, she introduced me to Nathaniel Lamb, the victim at the center of this case. Later, he made a four-hour drive to the Mississippi Gulf Coast to give me an interview. There, Harville welcomed Nathaniel, who's now 34 and prefers to go by Nate.
Hey, Nate! Hi!
Anybody home?
Yes.
4 months after that meeting, I couldn't shake Nate's story. I pored over news archives. I tracked down the prosecutor, interviewed an abuse expert, opened dusty court records. And with each new layer I peeled back, I wondered, how could this happen? And that is what we are going to find out together. Truth Be Told is the latest World Radio Special Report podcast series. Over the next 4 weekends, we're going to release the serial on the World and Everything in It podcast feed, and it's also available on our website, which is wng.org/truthbetold. Today is Thursday, November 18th. Good morning to you. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Myrna Brown. Here's commentator Cal Thomas now on the ways our government wastes our tax dollars.
Remember those shovel-ready jobs promised by the Obama-Biden administration in 2011? When many failed to appear after passage of a previous spending boondoggle, Obama joked, shovel ready was not as shovel ready as we expected. Citizens Against Government Waste noted that law cost $787 billion. Of that, $48 billion was supposed to go for infrastructure. It was disingenuously called the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act. Harvard economist Martin Feldstein calculated that each job created would cost taxpayers $200,000. When asked about that statistic during an interview with ABC News, then Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner did not dispute it, but he said, quote, the price tag is the wrong way to measure the bill's worth, unquote. We're hearing similar assertions about the new infrastructure spending bill signed by President Biden on Monday. Welcome to Shovel Ready 2.0. It's another swindle that has just been perpetrated on us in the name of infrastructure. Swindle, by the way, means to obtain by fraud or deceit. The administration and congressional Democrats claim it will cost nothing. That's because they are relying on accounting gimmicks and money they hope will come in through tax increases. But that will surely cost someone something. The new law is 2,700 pages long. I would bet my house payment that no member of Congress read it all before voting. But the Heritage Foundation dug into the details and found items that add to the debt will probably increase already high inflation and will likely further boost the cost of essential goods and services. For starters, the Heritage team says, quote, it bails out the Highway Trust Fund to the tune of $118 billion. The fund suffers from chronic deficits due to overspending, unquote. This is throwing good money after bad. But when it comes to government programs, failure is never an excuse to spend less money. Supporters sold the law to the public with promises that airports, highways, and bridges will be repaired. But the Heritage analysts note that the law, quote, adds as much new spending to modes like mass transit and Amtrak as it does for highways, even though buses and rail account for only a tiny fraction of travel. Even the value of highway funding is hampered by wasteful set-asides. $2 million per year for bee-friendly landscaping, $50 million per year to combat weeds, and expensive mandates that give unionized contractors a leg up on taxpayer-friendly non-union shops. If history is a guide, one or more of these set-asides benefit the special interests of members, possibly in exchange for their votes. It's an old joke, but true. How do you tell when a politician is lying? When his lips move. Unlike those who voted for this legislation, take the time to read it yourself, along with the analysis. You will likely conclude they have swindled us again. I'm Cal Thomas.
Tomorrow on Culture Friday, John Stone Street joins us once again, and a movie about a man with a dream for his daughters and the will to help them achieve it. That and more tomorrow. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Myrna Brown. The World and Everything in It comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. A reminder that if you listen to this program and benefit from it, would you consider joining with us in support? This month is New Donor Month, and as you know, it takes financial support to keep our reporters and staff on the job to bring the world and everything in it to you each day. WNG.org/donate is where to go to easily do that. And thank you. That's WNG.org/donate. The Bible says, they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. Go now in grace and peace.